Let me tell you what, who deserves a shot at the United States heavyweight.
Let's hear it.
I'm the champion. I ought to know. You know, I've been sizing up guys since I came to WCW. And I think the one guy that stands out the most, the guy that I think has earned a title shot, El Dandy, I think you're a heck of a wrestler. You're a great technician in the ring, and you're a jam-up guy. Well, I don't see any reason.
Wait a minute. El Dandy has been wrestling in the cruiserweight division here. Please.
He's a great wrestler.
He's a great wrestler, but my goodness sakes, you're 50 pounds.
Who are you to doubt El Dandy? Because this guy's a serious professional.
Well, let's talk about some serious contenders.
How about hypnosis? Let's get thrown.
Psychosis? Psychosis?
Whatever. He's a great wrestler. You know, you can say what you want. You can try to tear these guys down and take them down.
Psychosis has also been
a high flyer of the highest magnitude.
Yes, but he's still stellar cruiserweight.
Bienvenidos a El Sonido. Or as I like to say in English, welcome to the Sound Off. Trying to go multicultural here. It's episode 163 here for Sunday, June 12th, 2011. I am the Sala Monster here with you. Maybe I'll do a different language each week just to be fair to all the different listeners from all the different parts of the world that we're in. Do a little bit of a different intro for those people each week. I know I will fail miserably if I attempt to do that, so I won't. I'm going to talk tough enough. Raw. Actually have some praise for TNA. Talk about two crazy old men, and we have a presumed cause of death for the Macho Man, Randy Savage, and of course more of your stories in the mailbag this week. So a lot to get to, and let's just backtrack and start with Tough Enough. Of course, the Tough Enough season finale took place last Monday night, live, Not an entirely live special. We got footage of the training sessions from FCW and whatnot, but the Tough Enough finale at 8 p.m. did lead into the very beginning of Monday Night Raw at 9 o'clock, and it came down to two people, of course, Luke Robinson, who is easily the most hateable character on that show, and Big Andy Levine, or as he calls himself, Silent Rage. And in fact, it was Silent Rage who got unanimous support from the judges, and defeated Luke Robinson to be the Tough Enough champion for 2011. There's been a lot of mixed, mostly negative reaction that I've seen to the outcome of the show, and I will say that it was a tough decision to make. You know, neither guy lit my world on fire, but Luke has this natural charisma and ability to make you hate him that I think makes him more suitable to be a superstar on TV right now. He's also a much better ring mechanic at this stage of the game than Andy, who, even while training with Ricky Steamboat on this episode, this very last episode of Tough Enough, after all these weeks, the final show, he tried a leap out of the corner when he was in the ring with Luke. And again, Steamboat is observing this. And he came down on poor Luke's head and looked just awful. And he was still botching spots in the very last show. Keep that in mind. And for the judges, or one of the judges, I forget if it was Booker T or Bill DeMott, to talk about the fact that Andy has the, quote, it factor is ludicrous. Of the two of them, Luke clearly has the it factor, whatever the fuck that actually means. So I thought that was bullshit when I heard that. I got an email also from Roger, who's one of our listeners to the show, and he asked me if I thought that Andy won this competition because he had a baby and he had another one on the way, and that this somehow is a feel-good story in the PG world of WWE. And as I explained to Roger, that has absolutely nothing to do with Andy winning this competition. What had everything to do, in my opinion, with him winning Tough Enough was his size. Shocking, I know. Andy is a big dude. He's 6'5". He's got that physique that WWE seems to love. Now, keep in mind, 6'5" in the world of WWE, once you get on the main roster, isn't really anything special. When you've got 7-foot giants on the roster like Big Show and Kali. I mean, hell, even Goldust. I know Goldust is doing more backstage stuff as he recuperates from injuries. But Goldust, for crying out loud, I think he's about 6'6". But of all the contestants on this show, except maybe for Buckwheat Eric Watts, right? That's his name? Not the Eric Watts of years ago, the son of Bill Watts. This was a very different Eric Watts. You know, he was also a big guy, but the thing is, with him, he didn't have a clue. And Andy literally is just heads and shoulders above everybody else on that show. So the size was definitely something that was to his advantage. And while I sat here all season convinced that Luke was going to win this thing, you know, Martin was kind of nipping at his heels a little bit there for a while, but you know, especially after he went down with a broken ankle, I was sure that Luke was winning this whole thing. And then I saw him and Andy each come out for their respective matches with Bill DeMott on that FCW show. And I realized, holy shit, they're going to go with Andy, aren't they? Andy had the physique of a WWE superstar, and Luke clearly did not. I mean, even if I couldn't help, even I couldn't help but notice the difference. You know, that's why they kept talking about Andy having the it factor, as far as I'm concerned, because I cannot think of another reason why you would possibly say that about this guy. I'm sure Andy is a really nice guy. If anything, he showed on this show that he's too nice. You know, when they had the bottom three a couple of weeks ago, and it came down to Andy, Christina, and I think AJ, and, you know, Austin is, of course, just tearing into these kids. And Andy is standing there, this big dude, towering over everybody else, and he's crying in the bottom three. And Steve Austin is asking him, you know, who do you think deserves to stay? And Andy says, I think me and Christina have the best shot of becoming WWE superstars. That sticks out of my mind for some reason. I can't shake that. I can't forget that. And again, if you're in a competition to win, I'm sure him and Christina struck up a very nice friendship. She's a very pretty girl, but you don't do that. And he just didn't seem to get it. And so to me, you know, you're having this competition called Tough Enough. And Andy never struck me, quite frankly, as being tough enough. So, again, this whole bullshit about the it factor and this and that, at the end of the day, it comes down to size. That much is obvious. He's a big dude, and that's really all it was. You know, it's so irritating because they know that he really doesn't have it. But he's a big dude with the look. And sometimes that's really all you need. I'm not saying, again, that Andy was so horrible. If he was that bad, he would have been eliminated. But when it came down to the two of them, I just thought it was an easy choice. And I think they made the wrong choice. As far as this last episode is concerned, you know, I really liked the training and the family footage from the finale. It reminded me a little bit of those HBO 24/7 boxing specials or even the UFC countdown specials where they focus on the two combatants to build a fight. You know, that's the sort of thing I think WWE, quite frankly, should do more often with their main talent. You know, when they're building a pay-per-view main event between two guys, or as WWE main events usually go, about five guys, it would certainly bring you more into the story. I mean, if they showed, I'm not going to use John Cena, let's just say Randy Orton and Christian, for example. And if we had footage of, you know, Randy Orton at home with his wife and his daughter, which, you know, once upon a time, I would say, went a little too much against the Randy Orton gimmick, but he's kind of lightened up in recent years. And, you know, footage maybe of Christian back home. He's been screwed now in his mind a couple of times, and they show him training at home and get some comments from his wife about how driven he is, and they can get comments from Edge, you know, from his home and all that kind of stuff. It's something I'd like to see on the actual main product, and not just on shows like Tough Enough, or again, what I thought NXT was going to be at the very beginning before the vision for that show changed. So I really like that aspect of the finale. Ricky Steamboat was great. He came off just as a really nice guy, which of course is what everybody says about him off camera as well. And FCW made what I believe was its national TV debut last Monday with those matches. So congrats to them. So they bring out all of the eliminated contestants, and Jeremiah Riggs got the biggest reaction. That much was noticeable. And I honestly did not even notice that Remo was missing until I read it online after the show was over. And apparently Remo had some contractual obligations to appear at Planet Hollywood's welcoming ceremony for the 60th anniversary of the Miss USA pageant in Las Vegas. So I suppose she had a very good reason for not being there. And then we get to the finale itself, the big announcement. And, of course, as I mentioned, Andy wins, and Vince McMahon was in the ring, and Steve Austin was in the ring. And Andy gets slapped by Vince McMahon. and he takes a bump. Not only does he get slapped by the 65-year-old owner of the company, but he actually falls down like he got shot, which for him was great, because for him to not sell that probably would not have been good news for him. But for him to get slapped down to the ground by Vince McMahon and then get stunned by Steve Austin after he just won the competition, you know, taking a stunner from Steve Austin can be seen as something of a rite of passage, I suppose. But to have that on top of getting slapped without any sort of retribution, again, it's not like Andy got up in their face or he, you know, shoved Vince back or something like that. God knows Vince McMahon has no problem being the butt of the joke sometimes. You know, he's had his face shoved up Rikishi's ass crack and Big Show's ass crack, and he's gotten stunned about 5,000 times by Steve Austin. DX would make fun of him all the time. You know, would it have been such a horrible thing to have this 6'5" guy that just won Tough Enough, who you really want to try to get over with the audience, pop up and push Vince McMahon into a stunner by Steve Austin or something like that? Would that have been so horrible? And you know, what made it even worse was after he took the slap and he took the stunner, first of all, after the stunner, he popped right back up as if nothing happened, and he just walked off and is forgotten. And I just find that to be completely ridiculous. I mean, here's a company that they want so badly, and they need so badly to create new stars. And that was their goal in picking people with a wrestling background for Tough Enough this time around. You know, they didn't want another guy like Maven, who was too green to put on TV right away. Which is funny, because these days, 90% of the people they put on TV are too green. But, you know, that's what they were looking for this time. And yet they go and they do this to a guy who seemingly had the crowd behind him. You know, Andy got a nice little reaction for himself when he was announced as the winner. And, you know, the other funny thing is also, by the way, for all this talk on the show about wanting and needing a WWE contract, Andy already had one, apparently. I was not aware of this. He had been competing under the name Kevin Hackman in FCW. And his bio on the FCW website, which may have been taken down since I last saw it, which was a couple of days ago, his bio on the site mentions that his cousin was Dangerous Dan Spivey, the former Waylon Mercy in WWF. And, of course, Spivey was also a star in the NWA. I'm not sure if that's true. I assume it is. I don't know why they would make up an odd fact like that if it wasn't true and he wasn't related to Spivey in some way. But, again, I just find it funny that here's this guy, Andy, who is cutting these impassioned promos and they're interviewing him off camera like they do on these reality shows, and he's constantly talking about how he wants this contract and he needs this contract. And there's no doubt that he got exposure on Tough Enough that he wasn't going to get just floundering in FCW, but it's just funny, he already had a contract, and he was already wrestling down in Florida, and yet, well, that's reality TV for you. It's anything but reality, but we already knew that. So, congrats to Andy. I still think the wrong guy won, but I wish him the best, and hopefully, you know, he's the winner, he's the guy they're going with, so let's hope they don't drop the ball. Gee, I wonder if they will. And that brings us to Monday Night Raw. God, did I not like this show. In fact, beyond the Tough Enough stuff at the very beginning, I thought this was a largely boring episode of Raw. And when I get to the very end of the notes here, my venom will show. It's not showing yet. I'm not quite at the point of anger yet, but I will be in a moment. First thing I got to mention here, I am so tired of the endless parade of people who come out during the opening segment on these shows. They overuse this formula so much on Raw and on SmackDown that it's completely ineffective at this point. I mean, of course, I can also make the argument of why do we have an opening segment every week where two people come out or five people come out and then the GM dings in and makes a main event? Why do they go on the air live to 5 million people every week without already having a main event signed? Can somebody answer that for me? I guess that's a question that would necessitate some logic. So I guess that makes me stupid for asking it, but it just kind of jumped out of me when I was watching this show. Rey Mysterio beat CM Punk in a pretty good match, but I started to fall asleep during it. I think, you know what I think it was? I think it may just be that, you know, wrestling fatigue was setting in because I had already sat through the usual hour of Tough Enough. So to me, the first hour of Raw for the last several weeks feels like the usual second hour of the show. And anyway, somewhere in here it was mentioned that Punk and Ray had a match at WrestleMania. And while I do remember their feud from last year, which was pretty good, they had some pretty good matches, I have absolutely zero recollection of them having a match at WrestleMania. I mean, I just simply had no idea. I had to look it up. And sure enough, WrestleMania 26, a little over a year ago, Ray beat Punk. He beat him this week on Raw. He beat him back then, too. And in that match, he avoided having to join Punk's Straight Edge Society by winning the match at WrestleMania. It's really scary to me that my knowledge of Mania shows from, like, 20 years ago is as strong now and as vivid as it was then. And I could rattle stats off to you about shows that would make you think who in their right mind would remember this stuff. But yet, I could not remember these two having that match at WrestleMania last year. Just frightening. There's a segment here where Alberto Del Rio complained about Big Show damaging his car and saying that what happened was an accident. And Ricardo Rodriguez came out dressed up as Big Show with a singlet, a goatee, a bald cap. And he did a hell of a job because I didn't even know it was him until about midway through the segment. And Ricardo's always great, but that aside, this segment sucked. I know this feud is supposed to kill time until Del Rio gets a title shot, I presume, against John Cena at SummerSlam, but this is killing Alberto. I mean, what a waste of talent here. I do not like this feud at all, and I don't know if this is setting up for a match at Capital Punishment. You would think that if they do a car accident angle, and as hurt as Big Show appeared to be a couple of weeks ago, you would think they would keep him out longer, but like I said, Big Show's not really hurt. It's all part of the angle, so obviously they're building to a match at some point, which one would think would be on the next pay-per-view, but they didn't tell us that. Kofi Kingston beat Zack Ryder. I mentioned this because, yes, Zack Ryder got a match on Raw. Woo-woo-woo. He lost, but those YouTube videos seem to be working in that at least he's getting some time on TV on a show other than Superstars, which isn't even really on TV anymore in the U.S., so, yeah, good for him. I'd like to see more of it, you know, even though he lost. That's fine. If they can have Santino and Kozlov as comedy characters on this show, then why not Zack Ryder? I've said it before. I still say give him his own talk show segment, you know? Chris Jericho had the highlight reel. Carlito had the cabana. He's not even in the company anymore. Why can't Zack Ryder have his own segment? Book it. Speaking of booking it, Booker T wrestled on Raw for the first time in 4 years, or so they said. And he beat Jack Swagger on a countout after Swagger simply walked out on the match. This was so fucking stupid that I'm not even sure why they bothered having Booker suit up for it. What is accomplished by having such a horrible finish to a match? Wrestling 101 dictates that you use Booker, who no longer wrestles much for WWE, and actually makes a living putting over other guys on commentary on Friday nights. You use him to put over the younger Swagger, who you're actually trying to push. Does that not make sense? And if you're not going to do that, then fine. Have Booker pin him in the middle of the ring with an axe kick and get the big pop. Guy hasn't wrestled on TV in 4 years. Give him a win. But instead, they give us a lame countout finish that makes Swagger look even worse than he would have if they actually had a competitive match with Booker, and then if he lost clean. Which, again, not the way to do it, but if they did it that way, fine. At least somebody wins. You know, somebody wins, the people cheer, yay, and you move on to the next segment. I mean, this was dumber than TNA. And then they have Evan Bourne run out. He attacks Swagger to apparently keep a feud going that nobody cares about. I mean, it's not like Evan is getting over either with this. This whole thing was a colossal waste of time, and quite frankly, it really pissed me off. But this was the least of it. I haven't even talked about what happened after the main event yet. So, we had a tag team match with R-Truth and Miz teaming up to battle John Cena and Alex Riley, with Steve Austin as the guest referee. Of course, what would a John Cena match be without at least one loud spot being called on camera, so thanks to him, I knew that there was a bulldog coming during this match, and apparently so did the rest of the world. So then we get a tease towards the end of the match. I'm just skipping ahead here. Alex Riley, it looks like he's going to whack Cena with his trademark empty briefcase, and instead he turns and he clobbers The Miz. And there was no reaction to this big swerve at all, by the way. So Stone Cold gives Miz a stunner, Cena gets the pin, and the babyfaces are celebrating. And of course, the Raw GM chimes in, and he announces that because of Steve Austin's unprofessional conduct, he was reversing the decision and awarding the win on a disqualification to R-Truth and The Miz. Now, bear with me here, because I'm going to attempt to build what I am calling the first ever... Okay, this is a historic episode of the Sound Off here. The first ever Solid Monster Sounds Off chain of logic on this show. I'm going to build it right now. Steve Austin is the referee, and he shows favoritism. So he's helping one team out over the other. The GM says that because of this, this constitutes a blatant act of cheating on Austin's part. And he has no other choice but to punish this behavior by reversing the referee's decision. Not only that, but this constitutes a pattern of behavior by the referee. Because you see, Austin did the exact same thing to Michael Cole at WrestleMania. And much as he did here, the GM reverses the decision in that match as well, mind you. Okay, this is the same exact thing that happened at WrestleMania 27. So now you have two examples of this individual overstepping his authority and being penalized for doing so. Thus, one would think that the logic chain comes to an end with the GM never again putting this person in any position of authority. But you are a fool if you believe that. And the chain is snapped in half because you see, the GM announces that the only logical outcome here is to make Steve Austin the special guest general manager for next week's 3-hour Raw show. So basically, if I'm the GM, you have made a mockery of me now twice in a row. And so I will reward you by giving you my job. This show sucked. I mean, I rag on TNA when they suck, and I have no problem doing it when WWE sucks. This show sucked. This ending just absolutely pissed me off. I'm just sitting there watching this going, how fucking stupid do they think we are? And now that Tough Enough is over, boy, USA, they didn't waste any time in scheduling another 3-hour Raw just 6 days before the next pay-per-view. They're calling it the WWE All-Stars Edition, with stars from both Raw and SmackDown appearing. Well, of course. Of course they would have stars from Raw and SmackDown. How can we have a Raw show without stars from SmackDown? You know, it was a year ago this week I realized that the Nexus attacked John Cena and CM Punk in their first appearance on Raw, on what was ironically a 3-hour Raw show. I swear I can't make this stuff up. I just remember that show being a humongous pile of shit until that final segment, and it did a complete 180 at that point. I mean, it was different, it was edgy, it was exciting, it felt unpredictable, it was chaos and just total mayhem when the NXT guys attacked John Cena and they just tore up the whole ringside area. And Cena looked vulnerable for the first time in forever. You know, they were getting these younger guys over. The crowd was reacting to it like it was an NWO invasion from 15 years ago. It had a great deal of promise, so long as WWE didn't fuck it up. And, of course, they did. But that one angle will go down as one of the greatest in the history of Raw. And here we are 1 year later, and we see them doing stuff like this. Just incredible. I haven't seen all of SmackDown yet. I just watched the part that I wanted to watch, really, which was the Christian promo, where he essentially, officially went heel. And I've said it before, I'll say it again, Christian as a heel is money. So I'm very happy to see them moving in that direction. Apparently we're going to get yet another title match between the two of them, Christian and Randy Orton, a capital punishment. And, you know, a lot of times when WWE kind of marries these two stars together for a program and they have three or four pay-per-view matches in a row, especially when it involves John Cena, I complain because it gets very boring and predictable and maybe the matches aren't that good. But I will complain of no such thing here with Christian and Randy Orton. They have tremendous chemistry together. And you've got, you know, the pissed off Orton who got, of course, embarrassed by Christian wanting revenge. Christian, of course, is at the end of his rope. He's had two title matches. He's lost both title matches. He feels wronged, and he wants his belt back. And, you know, a very simple story. Orton, you can argue Orton is a babyface. Again, Orton as well, I think, is better as a heel. But nonetheless, Christian is, as a heel, I think, will do quite well for himself. And to me, you know, this is the third match now that they're going to have. And Orton has won both encounters. Christian just turned heel. You don't have a whole hell of a lot of main eventers on SmackDown. The stars seem to be aligned for Christian to get back the World Heavyweight Championship and then have Orton chase him. So hopefully that's the direction they go in. Got to mention something from TNA Impact. Impact Wrestling, I'm sorry. From Thursday night. I've actually got some praise, believe it or not, for TNA. In that they are at least trying to put a younger guy over for real. They had Gunner pin Sting in a tag team match. Pin him clean in the middle of the ring on Impact on Thursday night. And apparently the company is very high on both Gunner and Crimson. Is the other big one, who I believe is still undefeated in TNA. And, you know, you can sit here and argue how dumb it was to have a mid-card guy in Gunner pin your world champion the week before a pay-per-view. You know, again, later tonight, TNA's pay-per-view airs, the Slammiversary show, I guess it is. And Sting is defending the championship against Mr. Anderson. Mr. Anderson, mind you, who lost to Eric Young the week before on Impact. I could sit here and argue how incredibly stupid that is. But I won't, because that would be too easy. I will give TNA praise, because if they really, truly want to get behind this guy, and people in the company apparently like Gunner, and he's very nice, and seems to be improving and all that, so good for him. And good for TNA in this case, because even though the timing may have been suspect, one of the things in WWE, for example, when they try to put a younger guy over, and 9 times out of 10 they fail to do it, you know, sometimes a guy needs a win over an established main eventer. And by that, I don't mean, you know, Miz cashing in Money in the Bank and pinning Randy Orton, an injured Randy Orton, after he already wrestled the match on Raw and winning the WWE Championship. You know, I don't mean or Miz or anybody else that they attempt to push and get over, getting these fluky wins over people. I mean, Miz had a tough enough time with Jerry Lawler, let alone a guy like John Cena. So when WWE tries to push a young guy, the problem, again, is that they never get a real, genuine win over an established main event guy. When has that ever happened in the last couple of years? When was the last time Randy Orton or John Cena got beat, let's say by an up-and-coming younger guy, clean as a sheet, by pin or submission in the middle of the ring in the last couple of years? Nothing really springs to mind for me. Maybe another main eventer did, but I'm not, you know, another main eventer, I'm not worried about them. It's the younger guys that you want to become main eventers. And one of the only ways to do that is to build credibility in the eyes of the people. If Gunner goes out there, even in a tag match on Impact of all freaking shows, and pins Sting in the middle of the ring, people look at that and they go, holy shit, Gunner just pinned Sting. Now, of course, the key is if Gunner comes out on Impact next week and gets squashed like a bug, then this was for nothing. But I at least can praise them for attempting to get a newer face over. The thing is, though, Crimson doesn't really do much for me. You know, I still don't get why Samoa Joe is either the face or one of the top faces in your company. I don't mean face by baby face either. I just mean like John Cena is the face of WWE. Samoa Joe could be that person or one of two or three people like that for TNA. You know, could he stand to lose some weight? Of course he could. But he's an ass kicker, and he can make a lot more money for TNA at this point than Gunnar can right now. And I mean, again, I keep going back to, what was it, 2006, maybe? When Samoa Joe and Kurt Angle had their feud, and they had this big cage match at the Lockdown show, and I think they did the biggest buy rate they ever did, and part of that was also the promotion of that event, which goes to what I was talking about earlier with Top Enough, and, you know, showing them at home, or showing like training vignettes, and making it feel like more of a sport, which I know is a dirty word to WWE, because we're not sports, we're entertainment now, but sometimes you just gotta, you know, do what's right, and what's right and what's going to make you money is making people believe in what they're seeing. And Samoa Joe is one of those guys who can do that. You know, he can come off as a real tough guy, ass-kicking son of a bitch. And he's been under contract to TNA now for several years, and he even re-signed with them about a year or two ago because I guess he enjoyed working there. But I, for the life of me, cannot understand why they don't do more with him. You know, I first saw him, as many people did, in Ring of Honor. He was a tremendous performer. I don't just mean wrestling matches, because it's not just about matches, but Joe is great on promos. You know, if you let the guy do what he does best, he can be a top player, and to see him doing shit in TNA is just so frustrating, and I just wish they would get their head out of their ass and realize what they have in front of them, instead of sometimes pushing guys that, quite frankly, have no business being pushed, like Rob Terry, who, thankfully, you know, his push died down, but it's just, I don't know, it's just one of those things that that bugs me. Ultimate Warrior and Hulk Hogan. Now, I know I said that I didn't want to talk about this anymore, but now we have some actual bombshell claims from Warrior himself, plus you guys are just dying for me to discuss it, and I always give my listeners what they want. I am a man of the people, so I will talk about this, but only for a few minutes. So TMZ ran a story covering the video that the Ultimate Warrior released on Tuesday this past week. And in this video, which is really just about a 7 or 8 minute preview of a much longer, I think hour plus long video that Warrior plans on releasing in different parts very, very soon, I believe for free. I would certainly hope he's not charging for it, because that would be a little bit too transparent if he charged people for this video. But in the video, Warrior accuses Hogan of a lot of different things, a lot of nasty things, including using cocaine, having an open marriage with his ex-wife Linda, mocking Randy Savage after his death, and trying to get Warrior to have sex with Hogan's ex-wife, which Warrior, of course, says he turned down because, you know, he's a gentleman. So now, Hogan, as the story goes, is threatening a potential lawsuit against the Warrior. He's looking into possible litigation. And here's the deal. You want a scoop? I'll give you a scoop. It ain't going to happen. Hogan is not going to sue the Ultimate Warrior. For one, Hogan has already been through a messy divorce and tons of legal fees. In fact, I'm pretty much positive the only reason Hulk Hogan is still working for TNA, or even came to TNA in the first place, is because he got taken to the cleaners in that divorce. Otherwise, I don't think Hogan would have touched TNA with a 10-foot pole. He didn't all those years ago when he teased coming in, and he did that angle with Jeff Jarrett in Japan, and they were building to a Hogan-Jarrett match in TNA, and then, of course, it went south, and Hogan never came in. He always used that sort of stuff as negotiating leverage to try to get back into WWE, but the point is, Hogan's been through a lot of stuff in terms of you know, legal fees and things of that nature. Why would he want to put himself through that again? More importantly than that, the minute he files a lawsuit to refute the Warrior's claims, he opens up a Pandora's box that cannot be closed. Every allegation is going to be scrutinized. If there's any truth to even some of them, it hurts his case. I mean, they would dig back into his life going back 30 years and would find some pretty bad shit, I am sure, especially on the cocaine and the steroid claims. You know, it's the same reason that Donald Trump, if you remember that whole fiasco a couple of years ago, he threatened to sue Rosie O'Donnell for claiming that Trump had filed for bankruptcy at least once in his life. And Trump, of course, adamantly denies that he ever did that. And he never did sue Rosie, because if it's true, it would come out. So it's kind of the same situation here. Hogan, for his part, says the allegation of drug use is a blatant lie. And the claims about his ex-wife, he said none of that ever happened. This guy is out of his mind. I personally have never heard any of those rumors about the Hogans being swingers, sleeping with other partners. But the cocaine stuff, I absolutely believe. I mean, Dr. D, David Schultz, was one of the first people to publicly accuse Hogan of being a cokehead back in the late 70s and the early 80s. And I bet there are plenty of wrestlers out there, still alive, who were around back then, or traveled with Hogan, or wrestled Hogan, who could attest to that if they were called upon. I mean, the Hogan stories with the nose candy are, I think, fairly well known in the wrestling community. Now, you know, has Hogan been doing cocaine in the last decade? That I don't know. Wouldn't shock me. Wouldn't shock me, but I think we're talking about 20, 25 years ago in that case. So that's kind of where we are right now. Warrior is, boy, he did that tribute video to Randy Savage, which was very classy on his part. And you could tell that Savage was a friend of his. I don't know when the last time Warrior had contact with Savage. Perhaps they haven't talked in over 10 years, but he felt a certain kinship with Randy Savage. They got along. He considered him a friend. And, of course, Savage brought Warrior to one, maybe two, if you like their SummerSlam match at Wembley Stadium, of the best matches of Warrior's entire career. I mean, WrestleMania 7, he made Ultimate Warrior look like $1 million. And, I mean, hell, if that were me, I'd love the guy too. So he did that video, which was really classy, and this was after Warrior had been pretty silent for a while. This Savage video was the first I had heard from him in maybe a few years. And it just seemed like, you know, you've awoken the sleeping beast. All of a sudden, Warrior starts recording these little videos, posting on YouTube. He's into social media now. He's on Twitter. Soon he'll be on Facebook, probably. And he's doing these videos, teasing Hulk Hogan and threatening to reveal some wicked shit about Terry, as he keeps calling him. And we've got this hour-long expose, I guess, that's going to be coming out any day now. You know, I don't know if I ever shared this story on the Sound Off before. My meeting with the Ultimate Warrior back in, would have been 2003, I believe. And anyway, Warrior was doing a speaking engagement not far from where I was in New York. And I attended this function. And it was a small, I won't even call it an auditorium, if I had a guess, there were probably anywhere from 50 to 100 people. You know, pretty decent size. And basically, you know, obviously he wasn't dressed as the Ultimate Warrior. He still had long hair at this point, although most of it was gray, but no face paint. He was wearing a suit. Very well spoken, very articulate. People can hear him from the back of the room, even without a microphone. And basically, he did this nearly hour-long speech telling us about his life, telling us about his career, and then things got a little bit weird, and he started talking about the great books of the Western world, and he got into philosophy and some other whacked-out bullshit. And after the speaking portion, he opened it up to Q&A from the people, and there were many younger people, obviously, in attendance. And some of them were probably old wrestling fans, old Ultimate Warrior fans, maybe a few Hulk Hogan fans. And there were people who, of course, probably didn't even know who Warrior was. You know, don't watch wrestling, don't like wrestling. And I just remember that when the Q&A session started, things really devolved into chaos at that point. You know, he answered some questions, no problem, but then he would get asked a question that irritated him. For example, this one person, this one guy, asked him about steroids. And whether or not he had taken steroids before, would he admit to using them? And this just set Warrior off. And he flipped out, and he started cursing at the guy, and he made some kind of wisecrack about, because again, I guess the guy was talking about steroids, and also, why would you do steroids since wrestling is fake, and all that. And Warrior retorted by basically threatening to put him through a table. He invited him to come up to the front of the room, let me put your ass, as he said, through a table, and you tell me if it's fake. And at this point, I sort of perked up in my chair, and the only thing was missing at that point was a big bag of popcorn. I was going to sit back and enjoy the show. And Warrior got a couple of other questions that really got under his skin and reacted in an unprofessional way, to say the least. But when I went up at the very end to meet him. They were doing autographs and they were doing photographs. You know, I didn't need his autograph. I'm kind of over the autograph thing at this point, but I figured it would be pretty cool to get a photo taken with the Ultimate Warrior. And I get up there and he stares me down and I stare him down and he extends his hand and I shake his... You know, a Warrior in that video when he talked about Randy Savage, he talked about handshakes at one point and how there's this tradition in wrestling where when you, you know, come into the building in the backstage area, you have to shake everybody's hand. And it was this tradition that he wasn't a big fan of. And a lot of people tend to do these handshakes that are very soft, you know. It's not what he calls a manly handshake. Warrior likes his manly handshakes. And it's kind of funny, actually, by the way, that Warrior talks a lot about being a man and doing things in a manly way. And, of course, Warrior has done these other speaking functions in the past before where he's ragged on homosexuality and all that. And I don't know. You know what they say. You know, he talks an awful lot about being a man and manly this and manly that and rails on gays and stuff like that. And I don't know. I'll leave it at that. But the point is, I met Warrior face-to-face, and he squeezed my hand. Not to the point where he was crushing bones or anything like that, but he gave a manly handshake. So, if nothing else, he is consistent in his beliefs. And, yeah, seemed like a very easygoing guy at that point. He was smiling. We talked for about 15 seconds, got my picture taken with him, and seemed like a nice enough guy, but just very bipolar. You know, he'd go through these fits where he seemed very rational and very sane, and he was very nice to me. Got a picture and everything, and then with other people, he just snapped. And I think we've seen that side of the Warrior over the last 2 weeks. The Savage video was, like I said, very nice, very classy, very professional. A tribute from one friend to another. And this Hogan shit is just very bizarre. And whether the allegations are true or not, I just don't see why they're relevant today. First of all, in that video, he has some other stuff that he says about Hogan, for example, wearing hair extensions. Who the fuck cares about Hulk Hogan wearing hair extensions? It's obvious that Hogan wears hair extensions, and I'm pretty sure he's admitted it before. On television, in fact. You know? It's pretty obvious. If you look at the guy's hair in, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, and you look at it now, it just looks, it looks different. You know what I mean? And that's not natural. Hulk Hogan is not getting older and growing new hair. But, you know, you're lobbing all these Molotov cocktails at the guy, and then you just stick in there, oh, and he has hair extensions. Like, who gives a fuck? But I stand by what I said last week. At the end of the day, it's a pathetic, sad, depressing scene to see these two guys who are two of the biggest stars in the history of the business. You know, Hogan, Warrior, WrestleMania 6, that whole thing. And again, Warrior made the claims. Hogan didn't start this, but Hogan ain't exactly innocent either. Hogan is not exactly the perfect picture of how to handle things in a professional manner. Hogan has said a lot of whacked out weird shit himself, and his family is as dysfunctional as they come. And it's just very sad to see these two once, you know, superpowers kind of reduced to rambling cartoon characters. Speaking of Randy Savage, we have a potential cause of death. I say potential because we haven't heard officially from the medical examiner what the cause of death is, but Savage's brother, the genius, Lanny Poffo, claims that Randy died from a condition known as ventricular fibrillation. He made the announcement during an interview with Florida's Bright House Sports Network. Apparently, it's best described as an abnormal heart arrhythmia, and is often cited as a cause of fainting and heart attacks in people. Poffo also said that Randy's foot was still on the accelerator of the car after he suffered this episode. And it was his wife, Lynn, who of course was in the passenger seat beside him, who reached over and steered the Jeep into a tree, potentially saving the life of a motorcyclist and possibly people on a bus. So if that is true, that is certainly a heroic act on her part, and quick thinking on her part. She, again, was released from the hospital shortly after the accident. She suffered minor injuries, and Savage has since been cremated with his ashes scattered by his favorite tree down in Florida. So that seems to be the cause of death, but again, once we hear from the medical examiner, we will know for sure. Of course, they did those toxicology tests as well to test for any sort of drugs in the system, and those results have not yet come back either. Tommy Dreamer is apparently done with TNA. By the time you listen to this, he will have wrestled his last match. He was set to compete at the TNA house show on Saturday night, which I believe was one of their base brawl events. And apparently his contract expired, and the decision was made not to renew it, which seemed to catch a lot of people off guard because, you know, at one point, Dreamer seemed to be garnering some power backstage, and there was at one point, even talk of him potentially becoming a booker for the company. You know, when it was almost a year ago, actually, when TNA had their Hardcore Justice pay-per-view, and Dreamer was basically the one put in charge of putting the whole thing together. You know, getting people to come on the show and which matches should be booked. And, of course, he wrestled on there as well. So, in less than a year to go from that to this, it says a lot to me about TNA's financial situation. Because otherwise, I don't know why they wouldn't keep somebody like Dreamer under contract. He seems like somebody that they liked. Dixie Carter seems to have taken a liking to him. And I guess, something changed because he's gone from TNA now. Of course, this does beg the question, though, of why he had that angle with AJ Styles where he beat AJ. He pinned him on the last pay-per-view show. If they knew Dreamer was probably going to be ending his run with TNA, why would you have him pin AJ Styles, of all people? You can argue that AJ Styles is the franchise, in many ways, of TNA. You know, he never went to WWE officially. I know he had that one match on Velocity or whatever it was years ago, but AJ Styles never went to WWE. He's been with TNA from the start. He's probably certainly one of, if not the most talented guy, naturally talented, gifted performer they have on their roster. And you put him in a feud with Tommy Dreamer, have Tommy Dreamer, of all people, pin him on pay-per-view, and then Dreamer is gone just a couple of weeks later, and apparently they knew about that. So I know I praised TNA earlier, but goddamn, that sounds stupid. Skip Sheffield, who you may remember was part of the original Nexus Invasion, he was one of the stars on NXT Season 1. He's been out for many months now. He broke his ankle at a house show event, right at the point that it seemed as though he might be breaking away from Wade Barrett and Nexus, possibly branching off as maybe a babyface monster. Again, Vince McMahon was so high on Skip Sheffield at one point last year that he said, apparently, to people backstage, that he saw Skip Sheffield at some point being the number two babyface in the company behind John Cena. And unfortunately, he suffered the ankle injury. He's been out of action ever since. And he got on Twitter a couple of days ago and announced that he would be undergoing yet another surgery this upcoming Tuesday. He said on his Twitter, quote, "We'll be having a third surgery this Tuesday, and it will be the last. There are a lot of people who are far worse off, and this is all happening for a good reason. I wish I was back right now and doing what I love. But things are not right, and they have to be fixed. I will be 100% very soon, and back on WWE television. I thank all of you for your support." So certainly best wishes to Skip Sheffield. I also think that there's something there. And I don't think that's me kind of jumping on the Vince McMahon bandwagon. I think if you go back in the archives, there was at least one sound off where I talked about Skip Sheffield, and I said, watch out for this guy. Of those original Nexus guys, you know, Wade Barrett certainly has a lot of potential, and my God, have they dropped the ball on him over the last couple of months. He has gone absolutely nowhere, even though he's the Intercontinental Champion. But Skip Sheffield is a guy that, you know, when I first saw him on NXT as this goofy-looking character with the cowboy hat, I thought to myself, who the hell is this goof? But when he joined Nexus and he kind of sort of took on the role as Nexus enforcer, you know, he was this guy, if you go back and watch a year ago, the attack on John Cena, Skip Sheffield's in the ring kind of directing traffic at one point, and the other Nexus members are picking Cena up under the arms to kind of feed him to Skip Sheffield for a clothesline, and Sheffield just looks like this big, jacked up, intense, scary looking monstrous dude. And in some respects, very reminiscent of Brock Lesnar when he first debuted in WWE in 2002. Only, I don't know that Skip Sheffield is nearly the kind of athlete that Brock Lesnar was. He certainly wasn't an NCAA collegiate wrestling champion like Brock Lesnar was. But there's definitely potential with Skip Sheffield. He could be a big deal. And unfortunately, unless he gets his ankle fixed, it ain't going to happen. So hopefully he'll get healed up and back on TV real soon. One other quick thing I just want to mention here before I move into the mailbag and other assorted stuff. There was a story in the New York Times earlier in the week about UFC possibly purchasing the G4 cable network. And UFC, Dana White, they claim there's no truth to the story. But where there's smoke, there's fire. You know, Dana White has said things like that before. And then a deal gets done. And, of course, I don't want to say that he lies to people, but they like to keep things very close to the vest. And I tend to think that there is something to the story. Now, I know we have fans of G4 who listen to the show. I watch some of G4 as well. You know, Attack of the Show, of course. And I'm pretty sure it's G4 that has those episodes of Cops or Cops 2.0 where they have the live commentary from online, you know, chat room people during the show. It's very entertaining. But G4 is not a network that is available, for example, in nearly as many homes as a Spike TV or a USA. And this is significant because UFC's television contract with Spike expires at the end of the year. And there's been a great deal of talk that that deal will not be renewed. So UFC may be looking for a new, I don't even want to say cable home, because they could very well end up on a broadcast network. But UFC is probably going to be looking for a new TV home by the end of 2011, which would make TNA the only real, I don't want to say sports property, but the only real property that Spike TV has left, which would be great news for TNA. It would certainly put them in a position to be, you know, the number one kind of product on Spike TV, unless Bellator comes to Spike. Dave Meltzer of the Wrestling Observer seems to think that if UFC does leave Spike, Spike may just pick up the Bellator promotion, which is another MMA group. And Bellator, which is, again, compared to UFC, it would almost be like comparing ROH to WWE. And imagine if WWE got kicked off USA Network or could not come to an agreement and left USA, and USA decided to pick up Ring of Honor. I mean, it would be huge. So there's always the possibility that something like that could happen. From WWE's perspective, it's going to be an interesting story to watch, because if UFC purchases G4, is it going to be a situation where they're simply moving their programming over to G4? I cannot see that, because, again, G4 is available in maybe 30 million homes, I think, compared to 100 million that Spike has. It's just not a network that a lot of people have. And even if they did have it, they ain't watching it. I don't know what the average rating is for a show on G4, but who even knows if it registers? My gut tells me UFC will end up, if not on an ESPN or something, it could very well end up on NBC. It could, you know, anything's possible. But the point is, are they buying G4 to start their own 24-hour cable channel, which is kind of like what WWE is trying to do? They're trying to get their own 24-hour cable channel off the ground by 2013. And they're having some problems, because a lot of cable companies that they've met with probably would not give them clearance for the station. It's very difficult to get a new cable channel up and running. And so from WWE's perspective, they should be watching this story very closely, because if UFC buys G4 and their goal is not to move their programming to G4, but to use G4 to start up their own 24-hour cable station of some kind, the success or failure of that experiment could be very useful knowledge for WWE going forward. So this could be a very big story. Everybody's impacted by this. Again, it's a UFC story, but TNA would be hugely impacted by this. WWE could be impacted by this. It's something to watch in the coming months to see where UFC ends up. All right, so I want to give a quick thank you before I move on here to everybody who has friended me on Facebook at facebook.com/TheSolomonster. I posted a message a couple of days ago, actually on Friday. I posted a very special message from me to all of my Facebook friends, celebrating the 1-year anniversary of the creation of the official Solomonster page on Facebook. It's the official page of the Sound Off. We're up well over 820 followers and counting. And it was a year ago on June 10th that the page first opened, and really what has been created is a really nice community. A lot of nice people on there, a lot of loyal listeners of the show, some from the very beginning and some people who've only been listening for a couple of months. But we've got a nice group of people up there, and I took a photograph of myself holding up a very special message from me to you. So if you want to see the photo and you want to get in on that, you got to friend me on Facebook, and then you can post and see everything and all that fun stuff. So if you have not already joined, please get on there. You could also follow me on Twitter, of course, at twitter.com/Solomonster. But on the Facebook thing, again, I just want to say thank you to everybody on there. You make that page a lot of fun. And your continued support of the show is what keeps this going and what keeps this fun for me, quite frankly, because when I hear from you, I kind of thrive off of that. It's nice to know I'm not talking to a brick wall, which I have done before. So thank you to everybody out there who has posted on the page, and hopefully you will keep doing so, and we'll spread the good word to other people. So let's get into the mailbag here. First thing is first, I got a message from one of our loyal listeners, Sky, who many of you on Facebook probably know. And apparently his mom recently fell ill and is not feeling well. And just want to give her a quick shout out. Hope that she gets well very soon. Her name is Caroline, and she's in a bad way right now, but she's getting better, and I'm sure in the end things will be okay. But we've all been there before. God knows I've felt crummy, way too crummy, actually, over the last 6 months, even just recently with my throat, and it ain't fun. So hopefully she will get well real soon, and best of luck to her with what she is going through right now. Bill writes into the show, "Dear Solomonster, first, I know that some of the listeners do not read the Essie Scoops mailbag, but they have to read your response to the last question of the most recent posting. It was truly a classic. Even in my flu-like condition that I found myself in, that one question had me in a weird coughing, laughing fit for an hour." That's a good segue into reminding everybody that the latest edition of the SC Scoops mailbag went up on Friday. You can catch it. The link is still up there towards the top of the main page. And, yeah, we got some interesting questions this week. And again, all the questions are legit. They come from you guys. Nothing is... I couldn't make that shit up if I tried. But there's some good stuff up there, so if you haven't checked the mailbag out, check it out, and do post some comments in the comments section underneath the article, if you would be so kind to do so. But anyway, Bill's email continues here. He says he has read a report that Eric Bischoff and Hulk Hogan are at this point complaining about the writing of one Vince Russo in TNA. However, Russo will likely be a fixture for a long time to come in the company because Dixie Carter wants to reward him for his loyalty to the company by remaining loyalty to him. The question is Dixie's act of rewarding loyalty killing TNA? This was the same loyalty that she had that prevented her from acting like a president and making talent cuts that she was pressured to make late last year for what I imagine would have been for the fiscal benefit of the company. And I feel it's the same loyalty flaw that she possesses that eventually showed Tommy Dreamer the door, who, in all fairness, could have filled Russo's role quite nicely. Well, let me stop you there. Tommy Dreamer as a booker is probably not the best idea in the world. Apparently, Tommy Dreamer had the book for some time back in, I guess it would have been OVW, when they were still a developmental promotion for WWE. And Tommy Dreamer had the book for a little bit, and apparently he sucked at it. And I believe Tommy Dreamer's booking experience, even from the old ECW days, was also not looked at with a fond eye by many people. So I'm not sure that Tommy Dreamer is the best choice of person to succeed Vince Russo, although probably a chimpanzee would be a better choice, so why not put Tommy Dreamer in there? But to answer your question, yes, actually, I believe that is one of the things that is killing TNA. If she was not loyal to Russo, Russo would have been gone a long time ago. And who knows who they would replace Russo with, but to me, you have to take a chance. If you're not going to bring in a Paul Heyman, or you're not going to work again with a Jim Cornette, or bring Dutch Mantell back, these are all guys that have 20, 30 years plus of experience in the wrestling industry who are not too old to book a wrestling show. They actually do a very good job at it. I have no doubt that Jim Cornette or Paul Heyman coming in there would do a bang-up job of getting TNA turned around within 12 to 18 months, quite frankly. But as long as Russo was there, nothing will change. That's why this whole Impact Wrestling change, has Impact really honestly changed in the last 3 weeks or whatever it's been since that change took effect? Of course not. It's the same fucking show that it was a month ago, and it's going to be the same fucking show a month from now. Shit like that will never change when the guy writing the shows is the same person that put them in the hole in the first place. So your question has a very simple answer to it. Yes, Her loyalty is believe me, it's not the only thing killing TNA, but it's a very big part of why TNA seems to be spinning its wheels. And they never seem to make any forward progress. They get the same 1.0 or 1.1 or 1.2 that they get every single week, and they can bring in as many guys as they want to. They can have great matches, quite frankly. It's not going to matter unless you make that change at the top. And until she's willing to do that, or until the day comes that Dixie herself loses power and somebody else grows a set of balls and gets rid of Russo, nothing will change. Jim has an interesting email here. Quick question for you, Solid Monster. Have you ever used a, quote, wrestling term while watching a non-wrestling event? I ask this mainly because several weeks ago I was attending a soccer game, USA versus Spain, and while the USA team got a big reaction from the crowd, when Spain came out, the crowd went wild. I ended up saying to my girlfriend that Spain had gotten a huge pop from the crowd. She asked me what I meant by that, so I had to spend a few minutes explaining what it meant. I also noticed that during the game, when a player would go down after an attack on the ball, I would say out loud if they were, quote, selling the shot, or if they did, quote, sell the shot. I was just wondering if this has ever happened to you before. All the time. I think a lot of people listening to the show have had similar experiences before, where, you know, even if you're at any event, really, it doesn't even have to be a sporting event. I mean, hell, I've been on subway trains in New York City before, and anybody who lives in New York City or has taken the subway system in New York City will know exactly what I'm talking about. You get on a subway car, and invariably, you will end up in a car that will have either a panhandler or a group of kids or a group of people performing. You'll have somebody come on strumming a guitar. I mean, we've had mariachi bands that, you know, go from car to car, come into the car, they'll set up shop, they'll play mariachi for about 5 minutes, and they'll walk around accepting donations. And I've seen people performing in the subway who are really, really good, and they get a great reaction. The whole car is, like, just applauding, and they're like, wow, that was awesome. And I've sat there before thinking to myself, man, these guys are getting a big pop. Or at work, you know, if somebody did something wrong and they get yelled at. You know, I've used the term before, uh-oh, he's got heat. And again, these are terms I would never have thought to use if I were not a fan of wrestling and knew the inside lingo. So you're not alone, my friend. It's not the first time that it's happened, and it will not be the last time, I assure you. Brian from upstate New York says, with WWE's language list they released, would The Big Show need to be referred to now as, quote, the world's largest sports entertainer with tremendous athletic prowess? That would be the day that I stop watching WWE. I think that would be phenomenal, actually. If Big Show started coming out and they started calling him that, the world's largest sports entertainer with tremendous athletic prowess. That's actually a pretty cool nickname, I got to tell you. By the way, those language sheets apparently were specifically designed for the international announcing on their shows. I mean, some of those rules are adhered to by people here in the U.S., like Michael Cole and all that, but those sheets were specifically for the international folks. Apparently, they have to stick to those sheets to a T. And I suppose Big Show probably is already being called that overseas, whenever Superstars or Raw airs, perhaps somewhere in Uzbekistan or something. They're probably saying Big Show is the largest sports entertainer with tremendous athletic prowess. So I might actually have to move to Uzbekistan to check it out. That might make the trip worthwhile for me. Isaiah has a really good question here. Has Chris Hero ever gotten a look from WWE? I think the guy is super talented and can work the style. His stuff in CZW, ROH, and Pro Wrestling Guerrilla is tremendous. He has the size, mic skill, and ability to do well there. Why does WWE stay away from the guy? Keep up the awesome work. The Sound Off is church to me. That's a new one, by the way. I've never heard the Sound Off compared to church before. But thank you for that. You say that Chris Hero has the size, and Hero is a pretty tall guy, but I would argue that he does not have the physical stature that WWE is looking for. So there's your answer, because I quite frankly cannot think of another reason why they would not want him on the roster. He is everything that you just said. He is a tremendous performer. He's great on promos. He's a great wrestler. He's very entertaining, especially as a heel. I've really only ever seen Chris Hero as a heel. Even though people cheer for him quite often because they love him. I mean, and especially him and Claudio Castagnoli together as the Kings of Wrestling. It's just a tremendous act. And the irony in it is that Chris Hero, for a time, was managed by Larry Sweeney, who, of course, committed suicide back in April. But Sweeney was somebody who people constantly would just ask, why is this guy not in WWE? Why is he not in TNA? I mean, he could be the Bobby Heenan of this generation in terms of managers or mouthpieces or even as an announcer. I don't know if, you know, we'll never find out if his talents as a promo guy would have translated into the announce booth, but he was an uber-talented guy who never really got a serious look from any of the big companies, probably because he had a lot of issues that he was dealing with. You know, he was suffering from bipolar, he was suffering from depression, probably led to his suicide. But the point is, Sweeney managed Chris Hero for a long time, and so the irony is Sweeney is the same kind of guy. You know, people were wondering, why won't WWE look at him? And it's the same exact thing with Chris Hero, except Chris Hero does not have any of those issues that Larry Sweeney had. And so, therefore, the only thing you are left to deduce is that he just does not look like this big, jacked-up dude that WWE likes to go after. He's not a pretty boy. You know, he's got long hair, and he's not like an ugly man, but he doesn't have that pretty boy jacked up look that they look for. He ain't no Andy Levine in their eyes, and I think that sucks. I think if you would have had a tough enough season with real independent guys, I mean, the whole thing was they wanted independent wrestlers to be on Tough Enough, and they sent people out to scout different independent promotions across the country. And we know that Matt Cross, who was the second person eliminated, was an independent guy that a lot of people knew. But why did Matt Cross get eliminated? Well, on the show they claimed it was because he was too quiet. He did nothing to stand out, which is true. That is a legitimate knock on him on the show, at least based on the edited footage that we saw. But let's be honest here. He was also a lot smaller than what they're looking for. And but imagine, for a moment, if you will, a Tough Enough season with people like Chris Hero and Austin Aries and like real, well-known, very talented independent guys who can easily make the transition from Tough Enough immediately to television. You know, you don't want a maven who's green and you can't put on TV right away? Fine. Put people like Chris Hero on Tough Enough, because if Chris Hero wins Tough Enough, I guarantee you he can go on Raw that night and outshine John Cena. I don't doubt that for a second, but of course that's not the vision that Kevin Dunn, you know, the Bucktooth Bunny over there, and the guys in WWE have for what they're looking for, because they don't know what the hell they want. So unfortunately, talented people like Chris Hero get left behind, and it's a real shame. It's not fair. Luis writes into the show, is there an argument to be made for The Rock being the greatest transitional champion of all time? He jobbed twice after having the belt for about 4 to 6 weeks each to Stone Cold Steve Austin back in 2001 and Brock Lesnar in 2002. He may eclipse both the Iron Sheik and Mick Foley, who outright claimed that specific title for himself on Raw in 2006, in terms of sheer notoriety and jobbing without any complaining. I would say that absolutely, and I think The Rock probably would go down as the greatest transitional champion of all time. Again, the definition of a transitional champion is somebody who gets the title for a very brief period of time, strictly for the purposes of dropping it to somebody else. You know, Steve Austin never got the WWF title because they wanted to move the belt onto somebody else. No, Austin was that person, and Rock was too, but again, Rock was very selfless in how he conducted himself in WWE. He did jobs for people that other main eventers probably would not have. And if he didn't job to them, he certainly did a pretty good job of making them look good and giving them a lot of offense in the ring. Rock had matches like that with a lot of people. Lance Storm, he had a match on Raw with him once and made him look good. Rhino. I remember an episode of Raw from 2001 when Rock was having a match, I believe that night, in the main event with Rhino. And earlier in the night, in the opening segment to set up the match, you know, Shane McMahon, of course, was there at the time. He might have been managing Rhino, and of course, he was always that annoying little gnat for The Rock. Rock and Shane had some pretty good chemistry, too, but Shane was distracting The Rock, and when The Rock turned back around, Rhino gored the fuck out of The Rock. I mean, he gored him out of his shoes. He made him look like $1 million in that segment. And that really, to me, says the story there about the kind of person that Rock was as a main eventer in WWE. Very unique. The opposite of other main eventers. You know, cough, Triple H cough. But, yeah, Rock would also have to be the greatest transitional champion ever. You know, he beat Kurt Angle for the title in No Way Out, No One. because they knew they wanted to get the title onto Austin at WrestleMania, which they did. And when Rock won the Undisputed Championship in July of 2002 in a phenomenal triple threat match against Kurt Angle and The Undertaker, a match that you should absolutely go out of your way to see if you've never seen it. It's probably the greatest triple threat match I've ever seen. Certainly one of them in WWE. But, you know, they knew Rock was going to be leaving again. And the goal was to get the belt on him so that he can put Brock Lesnar over at SummerSlam. So by definition, that makes him a transitional champion. So I think it's a very good point that Luis makes. Trust writes in, will Miss Elizabeth's family allow her to get inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame? I read somewhere that her mother had banned all wrestling affiliates of Elizabeth's from the funeral back in 2003 because the mother blamed wrestling for the person that Liz became and ultimately for her death. If that is true, I don't think that WWE would be open to the idea of her going into the Hall of Fame if her family does not support it. Secondly, now that Mick Foley is leaving TNA, what are the chances of him going into the Hall of Fame at the same time with The Rock? It would make for a great class. Well, on your first question, I remember hearing stories about that as well. And it's going to be very difficult for them, I think, to put her in if they want to put her in. And part of me thinks that if they wanted Elizabeth in the Hall of Fame, she'd be in by now. She died almost a decade ago. And it's a situation where, you know, Elizabeth is no longer here. And so typically in a situation like that, you would have members of the family there either to do the induction or to accept on her behalf. And so if her mother or her family, I don't know how the rest of her family feels. I know Elizabeth had a sister. I don't know how she feels about it. But without family there to, let's say, accept on her behalf, I don't think you can do the induction. So I would say that so long as her if her mother does feel that way and her other family members feel the same way, then, yeah, it's going to be very tough to get her in there. But as far as Mick Foley going in with The Rock, you know, the idea of Rock and Sock going in at the same time is all nice, but I wouldn't do it. Mick Foley is a big enough name, and they, again, there's only so many big names that you can market around the Hall of Fame. They've already put a lot of the big guys in there. You know, the big guns, Austin, Hogan, Michaels, Bret Hart, Roddy Piper, you know, they're all in the Hall of Fame already. And who knows if they'll ever put Randy Savage in, but I would still do it this way. Rock goes in next year because they're in Miami, and his full-time career is over, let's be honest, so why wait? Put him in the Hall of Fame next year. And have Randy Savage in there as well, as kind of the either co-headliner. I know how WWE would kind of look at it. You know, Savage would be one step below Rock. But, you know, again, Savage is not here. And so I guess the genius or somebody would be there to accept on his behalf. And since Savage can't be there himself, I always said Savage deserves to be the headline attraction. And without Savage able to be there in the flesh, I just don't think he could be the headline attraction. You can't headline the Hall of Fame with a dead guy. And so if that's the case, coming off the heels of his death, if, let's say, Rock is going into the Hall of Fame, you put Savage in there as well. Those are your two top names next year in 2012. And you save Mick Foley for the year after, because Foley can be in a class as the headline attraction all by himself. And the same thing with Edge. And all of a sudden, you've got your next 3 years of the Hall of Fame top attractions all mapped out. So I would not put Rock and Foley in together. I think they need to space them out a little bit. Got some more stories about how you guys became wrestling fans. This one comes from Jason in San Diego. It says, I enjoy listening to all the stories of how people became wrestling fans. It's funny, I hear everyone say this or that about WrestleMania or Saturday night's main event that got them into the business, but I actually think I became a fan one day when I saw GLOW. Then I stumbled across a WWF. Of course, GLOW was the, was it Glamorous Ladies of Wrestling? I believe it was. The old promotion. I think Ivory actually used to compete in that group. It says, P.S., ever since your rant about John Cena calling spots too loud, I was watching Raw with people who don't watch it, and during the tag team match on Monday, it almost seemed like he purposely turned to the camera and called Bulldog. Everyone heard it. See, I knew I wasn't the only one. That comes from Jason in San Diego. Brandon in Iowa Park, Texas writes in. He says, I can't remember the exact moment I became a wrestling fan, being so young. It was around 1999, when I was 4 years old. I would always watch TV with my dad. And sooner or later, between Nickelodeon cartoons and Disney movies, pro wrestling became a serious part of our TV-watching regimen. Early on, I remember being confused with watching two separate shows, that being WWF and WCW. I remember mainly WWF because around this time, my father referred to Vince Russo's WCW as, quote, unwatchable. I do remember Bill Goldberg, Booker T, and Bret Hart from WCW around this time, but my favorite stars were in the WWF. As a child like many, Stone Cold Steve Austin was my absolute favorite. As I got older and my dad smartened me up to the business, I began looking at wrestling in a completely different way. Last year, when I discovered the Sound Off, my knowledge of pro wrestling was expanded and my love for the sport was enhanced. But as far as how I got into being a fan of the wacky world of pro wrestling, I remember my earliest memories by way of the Sound Off mailbag. I love the show and it makes my usually crappy Sunday evenings meaningful. Keep up the good work. That comes from Brandon in Iowa Park, Texas, who turns 16 this Tuesday. So happy birthday to Brandon. Tony writes in, he grew up with older cousins that watched wrestling in the 80s and 90s, but he says that I would say I became a fan between 95 and 96, and I've been one ever since. I had so many favorite moments. If I had a pick, it would have to be the McMahon-Austin era. I still mark out for Vince whenever he shows up on TV. Watching today's wrestling, I sometimes reminisce about the older days and ask why I'm still watching, but I think it's because, like most older fans, you think that one day wrestling will make a comeback and be great again. Let us all hope. Got a very nice email here from one of our listeners, Josh Wilson, in Joplin, Missouri. Of course, Joplin has just been devastated by the storms that hit many weeks ago. Josh says that he knows I'm late, but I live in Joplin, Missouri, and we've been dealing with the aftermath of the tornado that rolled through here on the 22nd, so things have been pretty hectic around here. Anyway, I was listening to episode 160 and wanted to commend you on your excellent recap of Randy Savage's career. It's always nice to hear someone talk about someone's favorite wrestler with the passion and fervor that you did. I, too, am a fan of Macho, and as a kid, I remember the Cobra Bite segment giving me nightmares. That, as an 11- or 12-year-old kid, was pretty damn scary. Many great matches of his live on and will continue to provide inspiration for years to come. I also wanted to send you my first wrestling memory. I was a wee lad of 6 years old, sitting with my now late grandfather, watching World Championship Wrestling on a Saturday night. And what I saw put quite the impression on my six-year-old self. I saw the Four Horsemen break Dusty Rhodes' leg. I was awestruck at how someone could get away with that. I watched every weekend with my grandfather father until he passed away in 1988. And after that, I've continued watching wrestling on my own ever since. I'm 31 now, and it may frustrate the hell out of me at times with some of the decisions that these companies make, but I've been a fan for a quarter of a century now, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. Keep up the good work. So thank you, Josh, for that kind email. Sal chimes in with his earliest wrestling memories. Hard to remember when I first began to watch wrestling, but the angle that got me hooked was the Paul Orndorff double cross on Hulk Hogan after their tag team match with King Kong Bundy and Big John Studd. I especially remember the outdoor match they had in my hometown of Toronto, Ontario, which drew over 60,000 fans. I believe that was at the CNE Stadium at the time. Unfortunately, it ended in a DQ, but it led to a memorable Saturday night's main event steel cage match, with both men exiting the cage at the same time, and the match being restarted with Hogan eventually winning the match. In my opinion, one of the greatest feuds ever. Thanks, Solomon Monster, and keep up the great work with the podcast. It was a great feud and a great turn, and they did big business with what they did with it, but I just feel like you can't call it one of the greatest ever because it just felt very brief. I don't know, to me it just felt like the Hogan-Orndorff stuff ended very abruptly. And, you know, hey, that could have been a WrestleMania main event too. I'm not saying they should have done that instead of, you know, Hogan versus Andre at WrestleMania 3 or anything like that. But I just felt like they kind of dropped the ball a little bit on that and could have done a lot more with it. Richie from the UK writes in with a pretty hilarious story. Says, I will always remember Randy Savage due to the fact that he is partly responsible for destroying my mother's bed. Allow me to explain. When I was in what we here in the UK call middle school, ages 9 through 12, I was mad about WWE and wrestling. In fact, most dinner breaks were spent either talking about it, swapping WWE stickers, or having mock matches on the school field. But I survived with bumps and bruises. Anyway, I was bored one Saturday and had just been watching a Hogan vs. Macho Man match, and I think may have been from a video from a match in Paris, and I went crazy for the diving elbow drop. So much so that I decided to try the same move in the house. I went into my parents' room, and as my friend Steven watched, I climbed up on top of the wardrobe and did a flying elbow drop right onto the bed. Unfortunately, I heard an almighty cracking noise, and both legs came off the bottom part of the bed. I looked at Stephen, and we both ran out of the house. I was later that day beaten to a pulp by my father, but I still look back at that event and laugh about it, and it's all thanks to Randy Savage. So, thank you, Richie, for that story. I'm sorry that Macho Man caused you to get your ass kicked, but it does sound like it was worth it. Gail writes in with an interesting observation. Dear Solomonster, I noticed that after WrestleMania, the superstars who participate at the event retire. I believe it all started at WrestleMania 24 with Ric Flair, who retired, although not really. WrestleMania 25, JBL then retired. WrestleMania 26, Shawn Michaels then retired. And WrestleMania 27, as fate would have it, Edge was forced to retire. With talks about The Undertaker retiring after WrestleMania next year, has anyone yet noticed this pattern? I had not until you brought it up, and obviously it's not something that's done by design. It's just fate, I guess you would call it. But, you know, of all the superstars that are getting up there in years on the roster, most likely to perform at WrestleMania next year, I won't count Rock. You know, you can say Rock's going to wrestle Cena and then retire. Rock's a special case. And perhaps next year will be his final match ever, but he's basically been retired already for 7 years. I say The Undertaker probably is going to be the next person who performs at WrestleMania and then calls it quits. And perhaps if we're all lucky, maybe John Cena will retire after WrestleMania 29. I'm only kidding, of course. Brock Benningfield writes in, still one of the coolest names of all the listeners to this show. I've always been a casual wrestling fan for as long as I can remember, but I definitely remember when I became a hardcore fan. I was a little kid watching the funeral parlor when The Undertaker put the Ultimate Warrior in a casket. I began to mark out so badly, believing that the Warrior could not breathe inside the casket because they used a key to lock the coffin, and backstage agents had to come out and pry the lid open. My mom tried to explain that it was all fake, but I was so worked up that I couldn't sleep that night. From then on, I was hooked. Well, you know what? That might actually explain a lot, Brock, because perhaps the Ultimate Warrior suffered some severe oxygen deprivation in that casket, which drove him batshit crazy. Hence the videos that we've been seeing lately. This all seems to make sense now. CJ writes in, he's been a long-time listener since episode 1. Wow, one of the originals. Just wanted to quickly share how I became a wrestling fan. To be blunt, I can't remember anything before 1992. I watched before then, but stuff began to stick in my brain, like Ric Flair debuting in the 92 Royal Rumble, Shawn Michaels breaking up the Rockers in the barbershop, etc. I have always been told that my father was the one who got me hooked on wrestling. He remembers my favorite wrestlers being the Rockers, Demolition, Hart Foundation, Mr. Perfect, Ultimate Warrior, Macho Man, and more. I started getting action figures and video games, and the rest was history. I still love pro wrestling from WWE to the local indies. I always felt like WWE was part of my childhood, and I witnessed it grow with me. In the late 80s, early 90s, I had the Hogan era with all my favorites. Then I witnessed the Monday Night Wars, Attitude era, and I was just becoming a teen at the time, and yet I am still a fan today. So to quote the Solomonsters' old intro, quote, "Man, I love this business. Wrestling will always remind me of my father." So that comes from CJ. John from Chicago writes in, "Do you remember the last time Super Cena lost legitimately? That is, without the heel using any kind of outside interference or weapon. Hell, has Cena ever lost a match via submission, for that matter? This is the biggest problem I see with WWE's struggling youth movement, especially for young heels like Sheamus, Miz, and Wade Barrett. These guys will never be seen as legit contenders to Cena, and now possibly Randy Orton, if they always have to win by cheating or some other nefarious means. In my opinion, these indestructible heroes need to show some sort of weakness or show that their matches are a constant struggle, or else no one is going to get over. What are your thoughts?" That's from John in Chicago, who has been listening since Sound Off 109. And he makes a great point, and I specifically mentioned his letter because I was just talking about this earlier in the show. You know, you can not have young guys winning matches by either cheating all the time, like Miz does. You know, when he was champion, it was almost comical how they just were so petrified to give him a legitimate win over somebody. He never really beat Randy Orton fair and square. And it's stuff like that that really hurts them. And so if you took a guy like a Cena or an Orton, I mean, do you honestly believe that if either one of those guys lost the match clean, by pin or submission that it would kill their character? I mean, if they start losing all the time, then yes, it will take some luster off their character. But if you're smart about it, it will not hurt their character. What it will do is it will enhance whoever is beating them. Because people will look at that and go, holy shit, I've never seen John Cena tap out before. Now, just to go back to your original question, I would have to guess that when Cena first came into the company in 2002, and I believe it was 03, when he first had his feud. He had a feud. I know his first match was on SmackDown with Kurt Angle, and Angle beat him, but I'm pretty sure Angle must have beaten Cena at least once with the ankle lock. So I'm almost positive Cena probably lost more than one match via submission early in his career, but once he took off as a world champion, I don't think he's lost a single match via submission, and that's fine. He doesn't have to be beaten by submission. He could be pinned, but I agree with everything you said. They have to show some sort of vulnerability. Kind of like what Cena did when he got beaten down by Nexus last year. People really thought he was getting his ass kicked, and this was going to be bad times for John Cena. And how often do we really think that about a John Cena match? Not very often. And, you know, you can only blame the guy so much. It's the way he's being booked. You know, John Cena is not writing these shows. He's not booking these shows. At the end of the day, that responsibility lies with the promoter. Otherwise, the promoter doesn't know what the hell he's doing. And it's hard for me to say that Vince McMahon does not know what he's doing, because he's been so successful doing what he does for so long. I don't know if it's just ignorance on their part. I don't know if it's old age, senility. Take your pick. But everything that he said is absolutely true. Vic from Vegas writes in, my first wrestling memory was in 1978 or 79. I was watching Channel 9 here in New York, and I believe it was Championship Wrestling. I'm not sure of the title of the show. Anyway, there was a ring announcer who properly pronounced every single name perfectly, except his own. I thought it was hilarious. I believe his name was Joel McHugh. Since then, I was a wrestling fan. Do you remember him? Do you know whatever happened to him? I actually did not know of Joel McHugh, so I had to actually look up some information on him. And his name was not Joel, it was Joe. Joe McHugh. And apparently he was a staple of virtually every Worldwide Wrestling Federation taping in the late 70s from Allentown, Pennsylvania. So it would have been for the old WWWF before it became the WWF. And yes, that is what he was known for. He was known for enunciating things to the point of absurdity. Like a really, really, really old school ring announcer. And he was old even then. And apparently he passed away back in 1993. So that's what happened to Mr. McHugh. All right, we'll do two more here. Ironically, this one echoes a story that I just mentioned about Hogan Orndorff was someone's earliest memory. And apparently it was for Bill Roop from Ohio, who writes in, Dear Solomonster, I first became a wrestling fan about a year or so ago before WrestleMania 1. I'm sorry, I misread that. I thought that said a year or so ago. I was going to say WrestleMania 1. Jeez. My first memory is the tag team match featuring Hulk Hogan and Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff against King Kong Bundy and Big John Studd. This was the match where Mr. Wonderful turned on Hogan and gave him a pile driver. I was so angry. I've watched wrestling ever since. So apparently that particular angle there had quite an impact on many people. See, and that's the thing. You know, back then, when you would have an angle like that where somebody would turn on somebody, it just feels like it was more memorable than it would be today. And I'm sure it has to do with the fact that we have live weekly TV where there's a lot of shit going on. And back in the day, you had weekly TV, but it wasn't like something big was happening every single week. So when it did happen, it stuck out in your mind more. Plus, there's that element of you're going to remember more. Things like that are going to stick with you when you're 5 years old or 10 years old as opposed to when you're 30 or 40 years old. But I just feel like those sorts of angles had more impact back in the day. You know, a simple pile driver by Paul Orndorff on Hulk Hogan is still remembered all these years later. And I guess the question is, in 20 years, are we going to remember the night on SmackDown that Christian whacked Randy Orton with the World Heavyweight Championship and turned heel? Probably not. Timothy in London, England writes in, Dear Solomonster, out of every film starring past and present WWE stars, which film is the best? Boy, that's a tough one. Well, first of all, I have not seen every WWE film, so it would be unfair for me to say that one is the best over all the others. And I'm certainly not going to vote for a John Cena film just because I'm not a huge fan of his movie work. But probably by default, in all honesty, I'll have to go with the very first WWE film, See No Evil, with Kane, which, again, was, compared to most other films of its genre, not that horror films that come out today are so wonderful, but it was still a pretty bad movie. But I'm a fan of horror movies, and I think of the WWE films that I've seen so far, this is the one that, I guess it was rated R. I was going to say it comes a hell of a lot closer to rated R content than rated PG content. And so I can appreciate that. And I'm a big fan of the Big Red Machine. So, yeah, I'd probably go with See No Evil, which is not saying much. But that comes from Tim. I said London, England. He just said England. I don't want to upset anybody. Perhaps he's from a different part of England. And last one we're going to do here comes from Gary. He says, I became a wrestling fan when I was a lot younger, and my Uncle Chuck gave me some of his action figures and introduced me to the games. After that, I was primarily a fan through these things and didn't become an avid watcher until 2002, when I would watch it with my stepdad, who was a big Stone Cold fan like myself. Ever since his passing, I've thought of him every time I watch Raw, since that used to be our weekly routine on Monday nights. So in a way, I owe my love of wrestling to him and my uncle. As far as wrestlers responsible for my love, I credit people like Hulk Hogan, Macho Man, Jake Roberts, and various stars from the Attitude Era. Love the sound off. Thanks for taking the time every week to record it for your fellow wrestling fans like myself. So that comes from Gary. So, again, big thanks to everybody who has emailed me stories about how and when you became a wrestling fan. And feel free to keep sending them if you want to. I'm still very backlogged. I have not gotten to all of them, so I apologize for that. But this has just been fantastic stuff. I'm pretty happy I actually came up with that idea in the first place, just because it gives you a different perspective. You know, you always... You know, for the most part, everybody listening to this remembers when they became a fan, or even if it's not the match or the moment, they kind of remember when it started or what their favorite memory is. And when you hear about memories from other people, you know, you realize that there are people listening to this show that have been listening or rather watching wrestling for, you know, 30, 40 years. And then you have other people who maybe only started watching wrestling a year ago. And the different perspective from different people, it's just an amazing thing. So keep emailing me if you have any other questions, anything at all. TheSolomonster@gmail.com is the email address, as it has been since day one. TheSolomonster is the also the address on Facebook. If you go to Facebook.com/TheSolomonster. Now, the thing is, I get asked sometimes by people why on the Facebook page it says The Solomonster instead of The Solomonster. You can blame Facebook for that, because when I first registered the page, for whatever reason, it wouldn't let me put the word the. And so I thought, that's interesting. What can we do here? And I don't know, maybe I had Shakespeare on the brain, but I said the Solomonster sounds like a good idea. So just remember that when you type in the address, you're not typing in the. It's just Facebook.com/TheSolomonster, and it should take you right there to Facebook. Twitter.com/Solomonster. is the place to go on Twitter. We're up well over 850 followers and counting, so get on there. And, of course, you can subscribe to this show on iTunes. It's free. You go in there, you type in Solomonster Sounds Off. It should come right up. You can leave a review of the show if you want to. Give us 5 stars, 4 stars, 3 stars, 1 star. Preferably 5 stars, but whatever the case may be, get on there. You can subscribe. And it makes your life a lot easier. Whenever a new show goes up, it downloads automatically, and you are linked in to the latest edition of The Sound Off. So we will be back next week with a brand new episode. Until then, this is The Sound Off. I am The Solomonster. Be well. Stay safe. We'll see you right back here next week. Thanks for listening, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.